Welcome to the bookshelf. Clearly this year, St. Patrick's Day got cheated. From Spokane to Dublin, the bars were all closed last night. So let's make up for that tonight and tomorrow night by hearing the Irish poet who for many years was a significant part of our community and the Eastern Washington University writing program, James McCauley, as interviewed brilliantly by Phyllis Silver on a program from 1983 called Inland Northwest Voices.
Welcome to Inland Northwest Voices. I'm Phyllis Silver, and my guest is poet James J. McCauley. For the last 12 years, McCauley has lived in Eastern Washington and has been associated with Eastern Washington University's Creative Writing Program. He is the author of 6 volumes of verse, including After the Blizzard, which won the Washington Governor's Prize in 1976. McCauley, the ex-boxer, continues the good fight in his poetry. From his latest critically acclaimed book, Recital, published in Ireland by Dahlman Press 1982, McCauley reads a sestina in which language and politics meet head-on.
An Irish bull, and I give you a dictionary definition. It's really not the real dictionary definition, it's just one I concocted. An Irish bull, an incongruous mixture of metaphors, often humorous, sometimes elusive or surreal, usually rendered in a political context. A low species of oratory developed during the notorious filibusters of Parnell's party during the 1880s. And this poem is dedicated to James Whitehead. Here's the poem. Political passion is the poorest coin we trade with. Slumped at the screen like resigned brokers or navigators, we're the last, we pretend, with the power to lend any value to words, so debased in the common exchange we feel them break from their moorings in meaning when we bring them to meet in metaphor, as if we could still make ends meet or tame any beast by such means. Words are coins thrown on a table to settle a debt that nothing's settled. In the news at last, Franco is dead. The smart men give us the word. He was good for Spain. Then a commercial break. Old Farrell, my countryman, 20 at the outbreak of that war when we both were born, went south to meet a fascist slug that sent him home lame. No coin, Spanish or Irish, could straighten his step, resigned as he was in his hatred, his only hope to outlast those fanatical, bickering, stomachy men whose word is good for business, always a good word with upstarts and fascists. We've worked hard to break their code, to invest in a language that's meat. But meanwhile, the enemy we know has coined a new name for himself and left no sign that's the least inimical, no word that lasts. Rage in Belfast, Beirut, L.A., the last news item, Dow Jones bullish. Then a word from our sponsor. The doldrums without a break in sight. In the boredom of bad news, we meet our worst enemy. Better to toss a coin, tails for the fascists sure to come up, and resign ourselves, like Farrell, to a bitterness designed for our own good to bankrupt the spirit. The last word for them from the newsman leaves no word unturned. Conservative. Euphemisms break into spume to show us where the breakers meet the rocks we've sailed too close to. But if the coin turns up the imperious head of coins, could we assign politics a lasting language, find the exact words? Or when the beast breaks loose, turn back to meet it?
Do you feel as a poet you have any power to change things?
Yeah. When I say yes to that question, can we change things? Yeah, I would hope that somewhere along the line I would write something which would make you see a particular thing altogether differently from any other way you could possibly see it. For example, Robert Frost's very well-known poem, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, right? He has a line in there, He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. Now, having read that line with what one critic has called passionate attention, I think it's Robert Hillier uses that phrase, you can't look into a woods during a snowfall without thinking of those lines. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. And I'd always thought of the snow coming down rather than the woods filling up, right? That's a very minute change of vision, isn't it? And yet it is a change. And hinged on that change is a whole attitude to property. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up. So, in other words, you know, he doesn't really own the woods at all. You know, because it's I who get the great spiritual benefit. I would hope that somewhere along the line, two things happen, right? I discover certain things when I write with the kind of intensity, really nerve-wracking intensity, that is demanded of writing poetry, that I would make discoveries worth trying to change somebody's mind with. Maybe in trying to find out why I didn't grieve my mother's death for 7 years, and writing a requiem, that I could find out something about love.
It seems almost naive, but when I read some of your poetry and I think about things that I don't normally want to think about, like aging, like dying, it gives me some kind of solace to know that there is someone else thinking about those things. I'm not thinking about them alone.
Mm. I'm often caught by surprise myself there. I mean, the actual theme or this is a kind of pompous word, insight, discovery that the poem reveals to me, it often creeps up in me and surprises me, you know, in just the same way as, well, hell, I don't want to be writing about aging or dying or any of that stuff, you know. I mean, I most often start off with a preoccupation about how can I get precisely down a particular image with precision. I'm not at the moment of composition, so to speak, concerned about what's this about. In fact, I'm not at all concerned about that. I'm working with the knitting, the stitching and unstitching, as Yeats says, of syllables that will make meaningful sounds that will convey an image to the reader, which will excite the reader's imagination into seeing what I'm trying to see. Do you understand? Well, there's a rather somewhat long poem called Flood. It's a story poem in a way, where I started out with a particular image, the image of what a flooded river looks like moving under certain light. It came to me almost like a dream. Again, I begin to sound pompous, but it's the truth. And as I worked with just getting the image down, the story and the characters involved in the story, you know, I've never seen a flood. I've never seen a flood of this kind. I just picked up the image as a possibility, right? And then developed a narrative in which that image could operate. Here we go, flood. We lost the reach of time in the wrong season for this weather. The rain beat a tambourine over the roof and gullied down innumerable channels. Was it 4 or 5 days before we quit counting? We watched, amazed, the antique process through our liquid windows, drawn from the idleness and forced by the spectacle itself, all that silvery light and the black ground hardly withstanding. Now, this night, it set a new pitch that roused us from shallow sleep, impelling us to begin lifting utensils and keepsakes from their places. With that odd cheer our kind brings to disaster, we tried to reckon how long and what power in water would rise against us. Soon we learned, simply by listening, not by calculation, that our choices had run out. We started uphill. Our flashlights made spangled strings of rain like a fortune teller's curtain through which we carried boxes of books and papers, the radio, the model ship from over the mantel. We set it all in a pile under the torn tarpaulin on the hilltop and assured ourselves by their disorder we'd soon return them to their places in the house. We huddled in our oilskins, quieted by cold, anxious for day. I dropped into a blank stupor. Tittering finches woke me. The rain had stopped. Light spilled slowly like thick yellow cream from the east behind me over the scene for which we were prepared, yet were confounded by. More like a harrowed field you could walk across from ridge to ridge, brown as our best topsoil, except where the poor light spun out on its surface. There you could mark how fast it moved, a stump waltzing round and round with a dead beast, a mailbox tumbling in a carousel of chattels. I choked back a laugh. The cab of our pickup was inching solemnly down the rumbling torrent. The alarm clock started its prattling under the tarp, advising us to rise for a day's work. No one had the heart to stifle it. By noon, the waters were holding level under the dormer that stared ruefully from the house at our drenched camp. That afternoon, we heard a high-pitched rasping south behind the trees, and Fred, our mailman, steered his old aluminum punt aslant the current, calm as Virgil in hell, to give us passage to the school where half the town had taken shelter. As for the others, some survived, the stubborn, the drunk, the defiant, Fred told us. He had seen their ghostly faces in attic windows. Some folks, he explained, possessed too much to be saved. The week had to end in a gold, relenting clarity of air before the waters eased back between the old banks, a river again, though keeping a sullen brown. Then we stood knee-deep in sucking mire like a living creature in our kitchen. We girded ourselves to begin again, mouthing to each other the old sayings, lucky to be alive, as charms against despair, and replaced on mantel and shelf our paltry mementos. Well, you can see what happened. You know, the one image that the poem began with was the harrowed field you could walk across from ridge to ridge, brown as our best topsoil, you know. And from there, the poem sort of works its way out into a story about what people do in those kinds of, you know, really heavy situations, you know, elemental situations where air, earth, water, you know, fire take over. And in that community, time will be measured. History, local history, will be, you know, in terms of the year of the flood, right? That was 5 years after the flood of 82, you know, this kind of thing, you see. Whereas what actually went on, this is a thing that fascinates me and fascinates a lot of other people too, like Wallace Stevens and so on. But the little hedges that grow between what we see and what we say. As Prufrock says in Eliot's poem, it is impossible to say just what I mean. James Dickey, the Southern poet, says, yeah, it's probably what accounts for why so many poets are drunks and complete failures at living, you know, that the failure to write the poem that is complete in the imagination and which comes out as this tawdry imitation of how the imagination has given shape and meaningful, expressive shape to experience. And then you get on the page and it falls so far short of that magnificent platonic perfection in the head. That's involved in this poem too, that, you know, what they actually experienced is not what they'll tell you they experienced, the characters in that story poem. They'll tell you, oh, we're lucky to be alive, and they'll just put their stuff back in the house and clean it out and, you know, return to normal, you know, whereas their imaginations will always be trying to deal with what that looked like, you know, what that experience really was.
You write about that, the magnificent line that is now erased.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Is
making an impression. That's a very funny little poem. It's intended to be sort of witty little throwaway poem about the disaster, the horror of failure. You know, this is what everyone who writes, I'm sure, certainly every poet, and certainly I, live with on a daily basis. That's why I do so little of it. Well, this is making an impression, which is, of course, a pun, right? And a pun is the slickest way to cover up that kind of failure, making an impression. Graphite bruises the page. Character by character, the slow pencil figures out my name. The ballpoint writing over the paper in a rage makes no distinction between above and below. To this one, profane and sacred are all the same. The fountain pen purses its lips, discreet, giving every appearance of taking me at my word. The typewriter chews the poem with blackened teeth, chatting between bites, making absurd mistakes. The eraser wags a stubby finger at the neat, unalterable lines I started with, now blurred. It's actually the rendition in verse of a conversation John McGahern, the Irish novelist, had in MacDade's pub years and years ago when Paddy Kavanagh was still alive, about how he uses a ballpoint pen to answer business mail, right? You know, and write checks and stuff like that, and the typewriter to get, you know, the thing on the page. And he used a fountain pen to write to his friends, right? And he used a pencil to write to his mother, right? And that stuck with me all those years when he said that.
In a way, it's terrible. Once you write the poem, the reader reads it and makes any association that the reader wants, and it's out of your control, just as I did just now when I remembered making an impression and I immediately associated it with the problems of writing a poem. It had nothing to do with that.
I know it does. Of course it does. It says right in there, you know, the typewriter chews the poem. Poetry is not exclusive, it's inclusive. You know, anything that you take away from the poem is fine by me, baby. In the way of you know, meaning and interpretation of the poem. That's one of the cruel things that education can do to readers of poetry, is to make them believe that there's just a sort of equation goes on, that the poem is equal to this explanation of it out here. And of course it's not. You know, otherwise it wouldn't be a poem. If you could explain the poem away, it wouldn't be a poem. So that your association, your reading of the poem as being about the problems of writing poetry is precisely correct. You know, that's what I found out by writing the poem, that this little ditty has a serious import. You know, the madrigals of the 15th and 16th century, yeah, they're light and airy and terrible. You know, they reveal terrible things about the human spirit when you look into them. I mean, God, the attitude they had towards women in those days, for example, you know, that sense of hunting that's running behind a lot of those, the most delightful, enchanting, heartbreaking madrigals, you know, and what they are is, you know, demeaning women, making them objects of sexual desire in the worst kind of way, you know.
You never would do that.
Me? What?
Reduce women to just sexual objects.
Never, never. There are about 44 poems of mine which seem to do that, but...
It's not really lust.
It's lust, yes. I'm willing to accept the idea that the voice you hear in certain poems of mine that could be said to be lustful, it is indeed a lustful voice. But lust has its own terrible punishments, as Shakespeare points out in his very famous sonnet, you know, the expense of spirit in a waste of shame, you know.
There's one in here. The girl is picked up by some little pup, awkward pup.
It's called Morality Play. You know, it is a poem about lust, but it's a morality play. That is to say that it's the enactment of a lustful scene that brings a comeuppance, a terrible comeuppance. I mean, the ending of this poem is intended to be quite bleak. When one is consumed by lust, one is empty of other human attributes, you know, especially unrequited lust. Morality Play, part one. It's a play. It comes in three acts, right? This girl, 19, adjusts slightly her blouse, small breasts, her features unremarkable, unlined, her fair locks parted straight down her scalp, surely by divine decree. She believes, I can tell. And not for long, I dwell on how, with her mother's wiles packed tight in her brain's coils, she'd still not find much wrong with my hand unbuttoning this ludicrous cheap blouse, sky blue, with little clouds of darker forget-me-nots. But after love, there'd be lots of mooning and baby talk. Later, her scolding, the salt for endless, silent resentment. It's all written there, relentless across the flat bust, the bare scalp where she's parted her hair at the severe mirror. The lot, makeup and blouse, not a jot or a tittle awry all these hard hours. At the window, I regard the foundered ribs of snow on the pale grass, lying low. On my scalp, a crown of soft pain. Act Two. Teaching such girls is a strain. In every encounter, they train to be tight-lipped mothers, spouses. For these comrades in buttoned blouses, the supreme commander is Jesus. Nothing's changed since the Middle Ages. Her features are as plain as the Bible I'd be perjured on if I libeled her in a fanciful trial of her virtue. I'd certainly fail if I wooed, God forbid, and won, and lived with her in sin till doomsday's trump to taint her neat soul. For this complaint there's no law book to give me due process. A boy in blue winter coat and jeans picks her up after class. Ungainly pup. The sky, this is Act Three. The sky has had this raw grain, like the underside of the brain, for weeks. Walking home, I feel insensate. The unreal is my guide through a labyrinth, as though I had drunk of absinthe. Cares abound, but I'll be tame, and turn enough cheek to hum aloud through my teeth to the trees clamped in frost. No ease could I teach them for any season. I hum like these pines. I have reason.
I was going to ask you, what was the poem that would be the most personal?
Anything to do with the family. These are poems I find very hard to read without drifting off into my own emotions, so to speak, which is a shame because, in a sense, they're the ones that I have the most stake in, emotional stake in, you know. But any time I try to read them publicly, you know, I find that my own emotional involvement gets in the way of the poem, which is criminal for a poet to let happen.
But in writing the poem, you don't go through that as much as you would in reading it.
More so, more so.
Really?
Oh, God, yeah.
So the act of producing it is still not, it still isn't distilled enough.
The process is one of the distilling, exactly, distilling those emotions. But if you don't have those emotions, it's pointless writing.
Earlier you said that you sometimes you start with an image, that it's more of an academic, not academic, but an exercise, you know, using an image and developing it. And now you're talking about starting from a very great passion or emotion, you know, where there's no point in writing. I can imagine that you come at it both ways, you know, I mean, at different times.
You know, when you're talking about this in an academic setting, even in a setting like this, one is inclined to separate these things out so you can look at them separately and talk about them analytically. But when I'm writing, I'm not aware. I'm much more aware of that kind of energy that is being generated by that complex of image and emotion and memory and thought and even the conflict between what I actually feel, which was, in the case of my father's death, rage. You know, Dylan Thomas has a great poem about that. When I ought to feel grief, when I ought to feel saddened by his death, I feel enraged by his death, and that conflict really generates a lot of heat, a lot of energy, and that takes, that actually, in the case of my father's death, took the shape of a very powerful, recurrent, unavoidable image of the cockpit that he died in.
You know, you said earlier that 90% of our time was spent doing things other than what we want to do. I was just thinking, with all of that energy and the feelings that you have, if you were really freed to do poetry 24 hours a day or wherever your waking day or would be, I wonder how you, what you would be like.
I'd say I'd last probably a month, 6 weeks, 6 months at best, and I'd be picked up and put away.
Do you think the audience or the people who read your poem appreciate that? Know that?
I don't know. I don't think that matters. I wouldn't have said this 10 years ago. I wouldn't have said it for the world, at least not mean it when I say it. The ultimate ambition of the poet is to be entirely anonymous. If the reader is constantly aware of a performance going on, here I am in this poem doing my thing. Did you notice what a good little metaphor I worked out there? How symbolic that language got. You know, that's not the name of the game. The initial ambition of the poet, I would say, is to be able to write a poem that everybody says, oh, that's a Macaulay poem, or that's a Tom Kinsler poem, or that's a Shakespeare sonnet, you know. I think the ultimate ambition is to disappear out of the poetry altogether.
The imagination and poetry of James J. Macaulay will be further explored in the second half of this two-part conversation. The engineer for this broadcast was Richard Wharton. I'm Phyllis Silver. Thank you for listening to Inland Northwest Voices, produced at KPBX, Spokane Public Radio. This program is supported in part by the Washington Commission for the Humanities and the Washington State Arts Commission.
Tune in tomorrow night to hear the conclusion of this 40th anniversary series.